Welcome back. This is Ask the Compound, a show where you, the audience, sets the objectives. Duncan wears a Hawaiian shirt way too early.
It's
spring break.
It feels
that's
like Hawaii. It feels
spring
like Hawaii
break.
In New York City today.
All right, looks nice. Today we have questions about what your returns should look like over the past 9 to 10 years if you're trying to benchmark. What's my problem with risk-adjusted returns? I'm getting to it today, Cliff. Does it ever make sense to take profits from retirement savings? How much money you should have saved in your late 20s? How to break into the financial advice space? A question we get all the time, all the time. We're gonna answer it today, finally. And then the pros and cons of working with multiple advisors. Today's show, sponsored by Rocket Money. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. I'm using their concierge service this week. Their subscription cancellation assistant is working on lowering my internet bill. They're working on it. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. John, our producer in the background, just said today he started using Rocket Money. They found he was paying for a website that he doesn't use anymore. Boom, canceled. Save John money. He can probably afford like half a beer in New York now.
Yeah, it's probably true. Yeah, you could work for them with all your experience at canceling things and getting better rates. You could work for Rocket Money.
Sure, I should be one of their agents.
Yeah.
Cancel all your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/ATC. That's rocketmoney.com/ATC. It's worth it. We've got everyone in the compound using it now. All right.
Oh,
let's do it.
Before we get started, I have to announce we did last week. We asked everyone to sign up for the Compound newsletter. We had a great response. So thank you to everyone who signed up. If you still haven't signed up, look in the description below. Sign up. You get updates. You'll never miss anything from the Compound. And very importantly, you always find out who the next week's TCAF guest is. It's the only place we release that information. But we did a drawing of the people who signed up last week, and Jennifer won. So I've already been in touch with Jennifer, and we're going to be sending some merch. We're going to send her some stuff from the shop. So, and it was so popular, okay.
We even highlight stuff from the shop there.
Yeah, yeah.
On the newsletter.
Yeah, exactly. We do, yeah. And it was so popular, we're going to do it again. So yeah, if you haven't signed up, do it again. We're going to do it for the next week. And yeah, so go ahead and sign up, and maybe you'll get
Link
picked
on
for
YouTube
some merch.
Somewhere?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, it's in the description.
All right, let's do it.
Okay. Up first today, we have a question from Eddie. What kind of 401k return should a 35 to 40-year-old guy be happy with, assuming he was more diversified and therefore didn't match the returns of the S&P 500? I'm at 10.9%, which is close to the Vanguard Total World Index since 2015.
Right. So we're talking annualized there, obviously.
Yeah.
He's 10.9% in total. Then there's some problems.
Yeah.
Portfolio performance can be tricky if you use the wrong benchmark, because I think a lot of people do just compare their portfolio to something big and well-known like the S&P 500. I don't know, maybe back in the day they did the Dow. No one actually follows the Dow anymore, if we're being honest here. So I'd say Dow is baby boomers, S&P 500 is Gen X and millennials a little bit, and then NASDAQ 100 is Gen Z and younger millennials. Is that fair? So S&P 500 can be a benchmark, but far too many investors compare to that index without like understanding that their portfolios probably look a lot different. So I think it really depends on what you're invested in. Are you invested in index funds? Are you invested in actively managed funds? Is your whole portfolio in stocks, U.S. stocks specifically, or do you have a more diversified portfolio? So look at the annual returns. I pulled these up since Eddie was looking for 2015. John pulled these up. A host of different Vanguard asset class returns. So we're talking 9.1% in the Vanguard Total World, which has been made up by 50 to 6% of U.S. stocks. Total U.S. stock is 12% per year. International stocks are more like 5.5%. REITs have not done well. They're up a little less than 5% per year in that time. Bonds, not great, a little over 1% per year. And small caps is about 9%, closer to the world total. So the returns are all over the map. So if you hold a diversified portfolio and you just compare it to the total U.S. stock market or the S&P 500, you're surely disappointed. But that's not a fair comparison if you don't own a portfolio looks like that. It's like comparing Guinness to Dos Equis, right? Both good beers, but those beers are better under different circumstances. If Duncan's wearing that shirt, he's better have a Dos Equis, not a Guinness.
Yeah, right? I don't know. I'm probably picking Guinness most of the time, though.
You can compare your U.S. large cap funds or holdings to a S&P 500 or U.S. total stock market index, but you have to have similar exposures to whatever your portfolio is. So if you hold a 60-40 portfolio, S&P 500 is not a good benchmark. If you hold a bunch of international stocks, the S&P 500 is not a good benchmark. Small cap, same thing. So one of the reasons why I love index funds in general is because the benchmarking thing is kind of a moot point. If you hold a total stock market index fund, a total international index fund, a total bond market index fund, those are your benchmarks. You don't have to worry about beating them because you're just tracking them. But back to the original question, if you own a globally diversified portfolio of all stocks, the Vanguard Total World Market Index, which again is 9% per year, yeah, you're right there. That's a good benchmark. Sounds like your returns are somewhere in between US and total world, so you're sunscreen in the right place to me. That makes sense. Duncan, what's your benchmark for Oatly?
Don't ask. It's, yeah. Things aren't okay. Going great today. We were just talking before the show, but yeah, my brokerage is not my favorite thing today. Maybe it's time to double down, okay. Right? That's what Ben always says, double down.
I mean, maybe you're watching Swingers, but I don't know if I don't know if you got that from me. That's Trent on Swingers.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, we got to just make sure the comparison is apples to apples if you're doing this. But it sounds like you're on the right track. All right, next question.
Okay. Up next, we have a question from Cliff, fan favorite, and in the chat all the time, Cliff. What is Ben's problem with risk-adjusted returns? What's your problem, okay. Ben?
Cliff has asked this a number of times. He asked it in the chat again last week. Can't recall what I said about this topic originally, but there is a more nuanced take than me just hating risk-adjusted returns. Listen, the whole point of an asset allocation in diversification is you're trying to get the highest possible risk for or highest possible return for a given level of risk. So risk-adjusted returns, to me, do matter. My problem with risk-adjusted returns is how investment professionals use them to cover their tracks. So when I worked in the endowment space, a lot of these funds would use Sharpe ratios and Sortino ratios and some other crazy downside hedged volatility ratios that they use those more than they talked about making actual money. And they did this mostly because these hurdle rates were easier to jump over with for their bonuses. But it was kind of a way for them to show that their crappy hedge fund returns were actually better than they looked. Okay, I know these returns look crappy, but if you actually risk adjust them, they're not so bad. And the way that they showed these, I always thought that the funds were way riskier than the volatility measures they were using, right? Because these hedge funds, I learned in 2008, had very illiquid holdings. They had very high fees, which you all know about. And then they gate your capital when you want to get it out. So is that not a different kind of risk? Same thing with private equity. Private equity is reported once a quarter, so it looks like there's very little volatility. And it's only not volatile because you're not looking and marking to market. There's still the volatility there. You just don't see it. It's like your house price, right? So all those risk-adjusted returns in that space were essentially made up. That's my problem. That's stuff that irked me, not risk-adjusted returns in general. It's just how people use formulas to cover up their mistakes and mask what was really going on in their returns.
I think my risk-adjusted returns are pretty good, personally. If you consider how much risk I've taken, I think it's pretty good.
If we take the inverse of your volatility, you're doing well.
Probably.
All right, next question.
All right, up next we have a question.
There you go, Cliff. I don't really hate risk-adjusted returns. I hate how they're used to mask underperformance.
I think Cliff is more just like asking.
If you're underperforming, just admit it.
I think he's just asking what's your problem, really, you know?
Yes.
I think that's what he's asking.
I got a lot of problems with you people. All right, next question.
All right, up next we have a question from Gavin. As a long-term investor, how do you decide when to take profits if you are mid-40s and investing for retirement? I struggle with this because I know I will probably never get the prices I got in the past if I sell, but I'm scared of the round trip as well. This is a great question. I talk with a lot of people about this. This is the hardest part of investing. I know I'm saying the obvious, but knowing like when to get out of a stock is the hardest thing.
Well, so this is why investing in middle age can be tricky because you're essentially in two camps, right? You should own some financial assets now that you want to see them go up in price, but you're still saving and you're a net saver for years and years, maybe decades to come, and you should welcome bear markets and lower prices. But the thing is, like the hardest part about building actual wealth is the losses sting the more money you have. So a 10% loss on a $100,000 portfolio is 10 grand, right? That hurts. But if you lose 10% on $1 million, you're down 100 grand. That hurts even more. So the dollar amounts hurt more than the percentages. So like, oh, thanks, Captain Obvious. That duh. But it's true. And so this idea of locking in profits, if Gavin is in his mid-40s, he's probably been saving for, let's call it 15 to 25 years. Considering the market environment and where we are today, he's probably got some decent profits and healthy gains. So the thing is, okay, let's say you sell some stocks to lighten up a little bit. Then what? That's the question. That's always like, okay, what next? So are you timing the market or are you changing your allocation? There's a huge difference here. So reducing your equity risk as you age makes sense because you don't have as much time to make up for bear markets. You're not going to be saving as much in the future. But I don't think you sell stocks just because you feel like they should. Like, well, I think they should go down, so I'll sell them. Like, you have to have a plan of attack. Some people make a sweeping change and go, I'm going from 100% stocks to 80-20 or 90-10. And they, right away, rip the Band-Aid off. But other people have this slower glide path where they say, okay, 1% to 2% per year for the next 10 years, and that'll get me up to my target of 85% stocks or down to that target. And or you could just put new contributions into bonds or cash or something else, some other diversifier, to get lighten up on the equity risk. So I think there's really no right or wrong answers for how to do it. The biggest thing is just you have to have a plan. It's not just I'm going to become an amateur market timer and get out because it seems like stocks have gone up. Because if they do, if you do get out, okay, I'm going to take 10% of my stocks and I'm locking in profits. Then stocks go up another 50%. Now what? Do you jump back in? Do you wait forever? Like, you have to have a plan of attack and not just wing it with this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we joke about my brokerage account a lot, rightfully so, because it's super risky. But in my retirement account, I have, or in one of my retirement accounts, I have a stock that has like doubled in the last month and is up even more than that this year, not to brag. And yeah, I was just looking at it the other day. Nice, I was like, should I just go ahead and sell this and diversify it, put it into multiple other things? You know, and that's, I think that's on a lot of people's minds constantly is like, yeah, when do you go ahead and say, you know what, this did better than I expected to do. I'm going to go ahead and spread it out and put it into some other stuff and see what happens. And
maybe that's the point. Maybe that's the point too, is like figuring out a level of diversification that you're happy with. I always tell people, own the amount of stocks you'd be happy owning in any environment. If it's a bull market, a bear market, in between, sideways market, own the amount of stocks you'd be happy owning in any of those markets, because any of those markets could happen. So don't try to guess, well, I think my allocation should be higher because I think stocks are going higher. That's the game you do not want to play, because that's just a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
All right. Next one.
Okay. Up next, we have a question from Mike. I was chatting with friends, and we all seem to have about the same amount of cash on hand, investments in the market, and income. I would love to get your perspective on whether or not we're behind, on par, or ahead of the curve. My father is in wealth management, but the majority of his clients are much older and have different financial goals than a 28-year-old. And then they share their stats. Cash and checking account, about $8,000, about $35,000 in the market, about $60,000 in 401k, and salary of $135,000.
First of all, I can't believe that we have 28-year-olds who are sharing this kind of information with each other. Kudos to you and your friends.
Yeah, my friends and I do not share this information.
So earlier this week, I had a kink in my neck. And I didn't even get it from like something cool like weightlifting. I literally looked the wrong way and had a kink, and it took me down for almost 2 days. So I'm way too old to answer this question for 28-year-olds. So I wanted to bring in someone who's a little younger than me, who's closer to this age, who doesn't get neck kinks that put them out of business for 2 days.
Benny
Markets, Ben Coulthard, who is an up-and-coming advisor at Ritholtz Wealth with us. I won't say the number, but Ben hit a very big milestone for client assets this week. The guy's crushing it. Ben, median net worth in the United States as of 2022 was $192,000, which squarely in the middle, right? John, throw up our chart here, median net worth by age. So this at less than 35, it's under 40 grand, right? So this person is in a pretty good shape if you looked at like the entirety of the country. So we're doing okay. But how do you help people understand hitting goalposts and benchmarking and figuring out where they are, where they stand in life in terms of money like this? Whether they're comparing themselves to the median numbers like this for the whole country versus their friend group who probably went to the same college and similar jobs and similar incomes and that sort of thing.
Benny's about to pop. Look at him.
Yeah. Well, first of all, what's up, you legends? Thanks for having me. Third time, long time. I got a lot to say about this topic. It hits home for me. First of all, I will say, Mike, you know, as Teddy Roosevelt said, comparison is the thief of joy. All right. Take Elon Musk, for example. I used to look up to him a few years ago. I genuinely thought he was witty and funny on Twitter. He was kind of like part Keanu from The Matrix, part Steve Jobs, and just like generally didn't give a damn and was firing all cylinders. Now, fast forward a few years, he's like challenging Zuckerberg to cage fights on Twitter. He's trolling Bezos and Bill Gates. Like if a billionaire can feel like an insecure loser relative to his peers, like anyone can. So how I can relate, I mean, on the one hand, I grew up in an average suburb outside of Hartford, which, you know, kind of an average city at best. My parents did have enough money to buy me, you know, hockey equipment, pay for my travel teams.
Wait, was Hartford the whale there when you lived there?
They left like right when I got into hockey, which, you know, that's a whole separate bag of issues. We could, you know, talk about mom, forget about mom for a while. But vacations for me were like visiting my uncles who played high school football, like on the offensive line and stacked bricks in the summer. So, you know, in the eyes of my hometown buddies and my extended family, like I kind of feel like Mr. Big Shot. But relative to my liberal arts college friends who, you know, drove BMWs at 18 and vacation at their parents' place in Nantucket, like suddenly I kind of feel like a loser. So my main advice is just stop measuring your self-worth with numbers relative to your peers and friends. It'll always be a loser's game because even if you are Patrick Mahomes, there will always be a Tom Brady. And guess what? Enough of the GOAT comparison, by the way. Talk to me when Patrick has seven, okay?
Okay. Well, your point is a good one that, listen, there's always going to be someone richer than you and always someone poorer than you. So it kind of depends on what your frame of reference is. I always like to put this in terms of how am I doing relative to my past self? So are you making more money over time?
Bingo.
Are you saving more of that money over time? Are you increasing that savings rate, hopefully? And then are you improving your personal finances? That's the stuff that matters in your late 20s, not like what is my net worth? Because that stuff is so subjective and luck and timing of it. What kind of job did you get into? What kind of retirement benefits did they have? You know, how much did you save? Did anything else going on in your life at that time? At that stage of life, you still have plenty of time to make up for anything where if you think you're shortchanged for some reason. But to your point is just there's, especially with the internet, I think it's harder than ever to try to play keep up with the Joneses, because even if you're doing well compared to your peers, there's going to be people on the internet that are doing way better than you. And they'll let you know about it.
Yeah, that's for sure. Instagram is just one giant weird brag factory. I mean, to actually answer his question, like, I think he's off to a great start for a 28-year-old. He's probably making, you know, 50K more than I was at his age, which is about 5 years ago. Even adjusted for that inflation, it's probably 40K more. We've got like, you know, I had similar checking and 401k balances. So like, you know, he's technically outpacing me, but like I am now by far the happiest I've ever been. And here's actually why. Like I've found a partner who I love and will be my best friend for life. It took me long enough, but I landed my dream job and I still need to pinch myself that Duncan Hill and Ben Carlson are my colleagues. And notice that I did not mention any numbers there. Like, are there close friends of mine who make double what I do by hopping around tech companies and they drive BMWs and I drive a Toyota Camry and they own their property in the Back Bay that I can squint from my crappy rental apartment in Charlestown? Yes. Would I trade places with them? No.
I think
the only thing that matters is like, what's that?
No, I was just going to say, the secret is don't have friends that work in tech, you know, and then you can just avoid.
Yeah, that too. That definitely helps. But like, no, yeah, to your point, Ben, like if you like where your career is going and like you're growing your income and you're just taking care of your savings rate, like enjoying life with the rest, like, and you have a supportive friend and partner, like you've won. One day you're not going to give a shit about the scoreboard. Like for instance, yep. I have a client and wife in their 70s. They have a nest egg of about 2 million hard-earned buckaroos. They like to go to fish concerts. They drink beers and eat fried clams on the Cape. They contribute to their grandkids' 529s, and they are happier than Elon Musk.
Well said. All right. One more question.
And everyone should share this video with Elon Musk. Let's try to get him to respond. Come on the show. Okay. Up next, we have a question from Adam. I've been a math teacher for nearly 20 years, and I've taught personal finance as an elective for the last 10. In November, I passed the Series 65, and I'm hoping to open my own business as a fee-only planner that can focus on helping teachers with their finances and parents of students approaching college. So far, I've done the following. Networked with advisors in the area, especially some career changers. Met with advisors who specialize in or target teachers so I could see what I liked and didn't like about their client meeting style. Explored the XY planning network, and I'll probably use them to help with registration and compliance. Added myself to the wait list for the Amplified Planning externship. And this one has a second page. I have a lot of time this spring and summer. I'd like to improve my education and ideally start getting paid by somebody else as I learn the business and scale up / set up the RIA. I was also hoping to get some advice from you as I transition into a role in financial planning. Specifically, is there a way to get some paid part-time experience in planning or paraplanning as a career changer? And I have to admit, I understood only like half of that. So,
well, this person is pretty well on their way to, like, they've gone down this path pretty far. We get questions all the time from someone who, I'm in marketing, or I'm in sales, or I'm a teacher, I'm in something else, but I love finance, I watch you guys, I read your stuff, I want to get into this business. And I've never had a really good answer because there really isn't one. It's very hard to do, especially if you're coming from some other arena and you're 20 years in or whatever, and you've already made money. You're not just starting at the bottom of the totem pole. So it sounds like this person has gone pretty far down the path of figuring out what they want to do. They should probably talk to Tony Isola, actually, since they're going to be focusing on teachers. But Ben, you worked for a big asset management company before coming to work with us at the RIA. Any thoughts you can share on your journey? Because I think that helps a little bit. But honestly, I want to caution people that this is not very easy to do, to just start off and come work for a financial advisor. It's a difficult business to break into if you don't have some book of business you can bring with you.
Yeah, it's really a chicken or the egg problem. Like, I had your same reaction. Like, I actually slacked Tony. I'm like, hey, you got any thoughts on this question? I guess he's talking with Adam next week about this. So,
oh, good.
So I'll just give you like general blanket advice that applies to this and anyone who's looking to make a career change. Rule number one, no shot on goal is a bad shot on goal. There is literally zero downside to reaching out to people, and it's all only asymmetrical upside. Like, worst case, your ego is hurt for 10 minutes if you get a no thanks or a non-response, which, by the way, that will be the majority of your interactions. But like, all it takes is one response from a Michael Batnick like I got in 2017, and your life can change. And think of it as like, the more no's you can rack up, the closer you come to that yes. And
let me tell you a story. I did a talk at the local CFA Society here last month, and a guy came up to me and he said, hey, I asked you the question a couple years ago, how do I break into the RIA industry? And he said, I gave him some advice. I don't remember the actual interaction, but he said, I did it. And I said, oh, great. How did you do it? I want to know, because we get this question all the time. And he's like you said, he said, I literally called every RIA and wealth manager in the city and surrounding area and took them out to coffee, took them out to lunch. Anyone who would take me, I talked to. And he said, that's how I networked. But he said it was hard, and I had to talk to a lot of people and go through a lot of rejection too.
I mean, the other thing too, right, is like, yeah, I'm starting to get kids in college reaching out to me on LinkedIn. And, you know, if you start by reaching out and talking all about you, hi, I'm Ben. I work at so-and-so. Like, I want to get into this business. I started off with Batnick. I'm like, you're the man. I love your stuff. Like, I love Josh's stuff. I love Ben's. Like,
that is the thing about networking, is people love talking about themselves.
Correct. And no one likes to hear about someone else talking about themselves. So like,
yes.
Lead off with like the tire pumping, and then you can talk about yourself. And that's why Batnick responded to me. So yeah. Also, don't be afraid of the double tap. Like, I had to reply to myself once with Michael, because now that we know Michael, you know, he's probably aloof, distracted, something like that. But like, more than two unanswered touches, and then you cross the line from a
persistent to your annoying thing. Like, there's a big difference between a big asset manager or financial planning firm and a smaller RIA. The smaller shop is going to be way harder to break into than going and getting some experience at a bigger place first.
Yeah, like exactly. I'll say this a couple ways. Like, embracing the temporary grunt work and lower compensation is like necessary. Like, you have to be willing to take a step back, you know, in order to take two step forwards eventually. Like, it sounds like Adam here has the humility. Like, he mentioned a paraplanner role, which is, you know, close to entry level. Probably won't be too fruitful, both from a financial or emotional rewarding standpoint. But my concern here for Adam is the patience aspect of it. Like, if I'm an advisor looking to hire and train a paraplanner, I wouldn't want that person to then leave me in 12 or 24 months to go start his own thing. Like, I'd feel duped. I'd feel pissed that I have to go now find another para person to train and all over again. Like, what I think he can do is kind of be like, look, I'm here to learn this business and help you run yours for a couple of years. But frankly, I want to become an advisor one day. And that doesn't have to imply leaving to start his own firm. But, and you know, who knows, maybe he'll find his forever home like I did. But yeah, it's really about who you surround yourself with, Ben. That's everything. I started, so yeah, at an ETF provider. I got my sales chops. I did believe in the ETF suite. Made decent money for like an intro level. And I would recommend looking at like Fidelity or Schwab, like a big company that's going to hire 500 people, assuming that only, you know, 100 of them will stick around. And then I like made a little pit stop at an RA in Boston to like get closer to Ritholtz. You know, got my operational ropes for a while. And then one day Batnick DM'd me and, you know, my wish was granted. So it was kind of like a few different lateral, you know, moves that just sort of amassed a skill set that ultimately led to the destination.
Yeah. Your patience thing is the biggest part. I don't want to like dash any dreams here. if you really want to go for it, then go for it. But it's not easy to break into this industry just because of the economics of it and the way that it's set up. And it's not as easy as it sounds. Even if you love this stuff and you consume it daily, there's a lot more that goes into it than just a love of the game.
I think this particular gentleman spins his education and teacher experience as a strength. Like, it's not like he's doing something to, like, you. I educate and teach clients all the time. He's got sort of like one of those lateral skill sets that I talked about. What he needs is
he's got the niche right, though. If he says I'm going to focus on teachers, that's the idea. Is you want to focus on somewhere where you can add value.
Right. Bingo. Yep.
Also, networking tip.
Keep putting pucks on that.
If you're trying to get in touch with Ben, if you put Miami Vice or Target Day Fund in the subject, there's a much better chance he's going to open that email. I'm just telling you.
So. Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah,
if you build me up and knock Michael down a peg, I'll easily read it.
Absolutely. Me too.
All right. Last question.
Hey, last but not least, we have a question from another Mike. Wow. I utilize two money managers to manage IRA accounts. One invests primarily in stocks and the other uses mutual funds. The accounts are basically split 50-50 between the two. I manage my own 401k and Roth IRA. I'm 54 years old, and my thinking has been that I'm sort of diversifying by using these two managers. My question for you is, would I be better off combining the funds and using one manager, or do you think my current thinking has value?
So the godfather of financial blogging, Barry Ritholtz, told this story a number of years ago when I first joined Ritholtz. And he said, we first started out, we had a wealthy client come to us, and they said, here's the deal. I have $4 million. I'm taking $1 million and giving it to four different advisors. After 1 year, whoever has the best performance is going to get the whole $4 million. And three other advisors are already accepted. And Barry said, no way, we're not taking your money. And the guy said, what are you talking about? Why not? And Barry said, because the incentives are ridiculous. We're going to try to hit the cover off the ball and take a bunch of risk that you probably don't need us to take in order to hit a home run and double your money or whatever so we can win. If we do take this big risk and it pays off, we'll get all your money. If we don't, oh well, we tried. And that's the incentives that you're setting up by having multiple people like that. Now, this doesn't sound like it's quite that extreme of a situation, but I think that's the problem with having multiple advisors where you're playing one off of the other and saying, well, your performance stinks this year. My other advisor is doing great. If that opens the door for your other advisor to say, okay, we're cranking up the risk, and that's not a prudent decision, then that's when you can get in trouble. How many people have you had come to you and say, I want you to manage 40 or 50% of my money, and this other person is going to manage the other half? How do you handle those situations?
I get a lot of them. Yeah, at first, like, I empathize and I understand and hear his question. He's even self-aware enough to know that it, like, might not be the right thinking.
And I get it because this is a trust-based business.
Right.
Some people are like, listen, I don't want to just jump in right away. I want to like try you out first and then see if I really do trust you.
Right. It's just, yeah, the problem with that is like, yeah, to that example, it's like, okay, what's the significance of a 12-month time frame? And you might be tempted to switch over to the hot hand, right? When the hot hand's about to go cold, it's just decision fatigue. I'm actually going to pull out the great Nick Murray, who is an advisor of sorts and is definitely a pointed and very blunt individual. So this comes from his book, Scripts, which I highly recommend. He's got two pages addressing this topic. He goes, dividing your invested assets between two uncoordinated advisors is the one sure way I've ever known to virtually guarantee that your invested wealth will be rife with both gaps and redundancies. He goes, there could only have been one Eisenhower on D-Day. Any other way, the operation would almost certainly have failed. You wouldn't have two surgeons who never met before in an operating room while getting heart surgery, and you wouldn't divide your estate plan between two attorneys who have never conferred with each other. And what he's saying is like dividing your wealth between me and some other advisor disserves you.
That's the best point, is that the advisors are not talking with one another. And so you could be getting similar exposures or similar funds, or that you're just doubling up for no apparent reason. Nick Murray is the man also. If you're an advisor, Simple Wealth, Inevitable Wealth is an all-timer.
My Bible, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like the strategy would make more sense for like hedge funds. If you're like a wealthy person, you want to have like a couple of different hedge funds with your excess money.
Yeah, you're
or
diversifying
something.
By like, fund or portfolio manager or structure or bank.
But yeah, with your retirement, with advisors, this sounds weird. It could, yeah,
it can invite the wrong incentives.
Yeah, we talked about the incentives, but like on the redundancy and gap piece, like he did mention that one manager uses stocks and the other mutual funds. Well, does the stock manager buy Apple, Microsoft, and Google while the fund manager buys funds that own Apple, Microsoft, and Google? Like, you know, I'd encourage you to look under the hood. Where I do see, I have some existing clients where the dynamics are similar, where like we run all equity through custom indexing and then our trend following model. And then they manage the fixed income piece on their own because they get it enough or just through somewhere else. So like I can see a dynamic like that where it exists, but yeah, I tell people thanks, but no thanks. If they're like, yeah, we'll see how you do for 12 months, kid. I'm like, well, we'll see how Mr. Market does. And okay.
It's also could be like a split the baby moment of, I would determine which one of these advisors has helped you make better decisions. Which one of them has focused more on financial planning and figuring out like your goals and objectives, and which one is just managing the money and investing it. That's how I would look at this decision, is like, which one has really actually helped me here make some better financial decisions, and which one is just running my money for me in an investment strategy that could be doing great regardless of what they do because that part of the market went up.
Right. And lastly, there is a fee consideration too. A lot of places, if you combine, you know, your assets together, you'll hit a certain fee break point. Whereas if you split them, you're kind of like paying the high fee at both places.
True.
On the fee schedule. So yeah, I would call it diversification, not diversification, but I get where he's coming from. Trust is a big thing. You don't want to turn over the keys to everything to one person right off the bat. So look, I get it. He's just, listen to Nick Murray. There's only one Eisenhower on D-Day, all right?
Yes. And plus, everyone loves World War II stories.
Right.
All right. Thank you to Benny Markets for coming on and helping here. I needed that young voice to help me. Remember, email us, askthecompoundshow@gmail.com with all your questions. Leave them on YouTube. We even take questions right from the chat like we did last week with Cliff. What else?
Cliff, who was not here today. Can you believe that? Of all days.
I didn't even make it. All right. Cut it out. I don't want him to see it.
Okay.
All right. Leave us a question or a comment below. idontshop.com for all your Compound Show needs.
Sign up for the newsletter.
Newsletter. We'll link to it. And new Compound of Friends tomorrow. And we'll see you next week.
See everyone.
Thanks for listening to Ask the Compound. All opinions expressed by Ben Carlson, Duncan Hill, and any of their guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Ritholtz Wealth Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for any investment decisions. Clients of Ritholtz Wealth Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.